official K-1 podcast, K-1 Battlecast. You'll get news, fight reviews, and fighter interviews. And now, your hosts, Michael Shaverov and Jonathan Scheer.
It's good night, Iran!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of K1 Battlecast, the official podcast of K1 Worldwide. I'm your host, Michael Shavello, in Melbourne, Australia, joined as always up and over in Tokyo by my verbal sparring partner, Jonathan Scheer. G'day, Jonathan.
G'day, Michael. It's great to be here with you.
It's great to be back on the podcast airwaves again with you, my friend. How have you been faring this last week?
Staying busy.
Good to hear as always as we tick down towards a busy time, a good time to be a fan of K1 with so much coming up. And the biggest event of the mid-year, there's so many to choose from, but July 7 in Tokyo, Japan. It is going to be the K1 Max Final on July 7 at Yoyogi. And Jonathan, I am so excited for this. I can hardly contain it.
I cannot agree more. There's so many great fights on this lineup. Where to begin?
Man, so we continue our deep dive today. Every week, folks, we've been looking at one of the eight participants in the K1 Max Final on July 7. And this week, we're going to look at the man who is universally considered the favorite for this tournament. I'm talking about the Chinese new emperor of Asia, is his nickname, Wu Yangfeng. Jonathan, I just want to get from you, what pops into your mind? What images are conjured inside your mind when I say the name Wu Yangfeng?
Okay, I'm a big fan of what he does in the ring, Michael, but I'm also a big fan of his ring entrance, that whole theatrical performance. It's so much fun, the whole kung fu feeling of it, and I'm a big fan of his.
Well, let's get stuck into it then. Our deep dive into Wu Yangfeng, and my first impressions of Wu Yangfeng, well, I first saw Feng in the hotel lobby a couple of days before the fight on March 20, and my thought was, this guy's built. He is solid, big chest, big legs, very old school sporty look about him, if that makes sense. Like one of those pro athletes stuck in the late 1990s who has come from some hardcore training camp and has been built piece by piece for this fight. It's like Wu Yangfeng has been machine-made, like he's been engineered for kickboxing success. That was my first thought when I saw him in the lobby. Let me tell you, folks, Wu Yangfeng is a nasty man. We go to the fight, and even before the match starts, he tries to mentally break Pascal Schrutt. He does that cool, long walk out to the ring with the robe and the Chinese hat. He takes his time in the corner, makes Pascal wait. I mean, the whole world is on Feng's time. He's already establishing control. And when he peels his shirt off, we see that he is jacked. The dude is freaking huge, ripped, Chinese beefcake. Impressive specimen. From the opening bell, Feng is on the balls of his feet. He's lively. He's moving around. He's setting a very high pace. He's taking anything Schrutt throws at him and is completely unfazed. And when he closes the gap, he throws combinations. And let me tell you, these are no tippy-tap combos. This is power stuff. Feng's got tight boxing. He turns the knuckles in. The punches are fast. They're accurate. They're power-laden. And he particularly has this lovely body shot, this liver punch, looking to drive those knuckles between the 9th and 10th ribs and impact the vagus nerve. It's vicious stuff. It really is. Pascal Schrutt does land some clean blows on Feng. And Schrutt is no slouch. He's no tomato can. Schrutt is a legit Muay Thai champion. He lives in Thailand, owns his own gym in Thailand, got plenty of experience. But nothing he lands seems to make an impact on Wu Yangfeng. And Feng fires right crosses, careens body shots, one after another, designed to shut down organs. Once again, these are vicious body shots. And he throws them like he's throwing candy. It's just one after the other. There's not a lot of kicking from Wu Yangfeng. He's a boxer primarily. and his boxing is bloody strong. He keeps coming forward. He keeps throwing heavy. He doesn't set up a lot. He just goes for it, especially to the body. And he shows off a pretty decent uppercut off the right hand as well. Already in the first round, you can see why Feng must be considered the tournament favorite. You can see why every fighter avoided him in the draw. He is levels above everyone else with his boxing. Perhaps the only one who comes close is Zora Akopian, who also possesses a great body shot, wicked combinations, but power-wise, Feng has the definite edge. Feng is a monster, a relentless, primed, attacking machine. Once again, big reason why all the other fighters at the official draw the next day avoided Feng. I mean, Feng was the first one out of the gates at the draw. He went to the first bracket, quarterfinal number one, sat down and basically challenged anybody to meet him. And one by one, every fighter drew their ball, every fighter took a slot, and nobody chose to sit next to Ouyang Feng. It really did solidify, in my mind, what I already thought. And now I knew what all the other fighters were thinking, that this dude, this is the dude to beat. So in the second round, Pascal Schrutt ups his work rate. He round kicks the body. He round kicks the legs. He lands some left crosses at a southpaw stance. But again, nothing phases Ouyang Feng. Feng bides his time. He takes Schrutt's best shots and then answers back with more body shots, a jumping knee, more crosses, and everything again is hard and nasty and evil. With about 95 seconds remaining in the second round, Feng drops Schrutt with a well-timed short right hand. Schrutt is straight back to his feet and he's protesting the knockdown, but I think it was a down. And straight away, Feng goes back to that liver. His punches are almost lifting Pascal Schrutt off the canvas. It's chilling to watch. Feng brings in more knees. He's just backing up Schrutt from pillar to post, completely owning the German. Third round is wash, rinse, and repeat for Ouyang Feng. There's no signs of slowing down. He is no less nasty. He plants his flag and, man, the Chinese flag flies high. Ouyang Feng is a destroyer, guys. Ouyang Feng is a freaking weapon. The undoubted favorite for the K1 Max on July 7. Now, I've had a lot of people ask me, Michael, if Ouyang Feng is the favorite, who do you consider second and third favorites for the tournament? That is where things get a little difficult. But I would have to say that Zora Akopian would be second favorite for the sheer fact that Akopian is also on the other side of the draw away from Ouyang Feng. The only way that Akopian can meet Feng is in the final. So I think maybe Akopian's the favorite to get through on the other side of the draw. If I'm looking for a third favorite, it gets really tough because you can throw a blanket over all the other fighters. There's something about all of them that I like. I like the height and the range of Denge Silva. I love the in-close tenacity of both Mezhinsky and Daryl Verdonk. I like the heart, the grit of Romano Buckboard. I like the unknown factor and the one-punch knockout factor and patience of Viktor Akimov. You know, there's something in everybody that I enjoy in this tournament. But the big question is, who is the wild card? I mean, if it's Buakaw, it throws a whole spanner in the works. If it's someone like Alizov, I mean, you've got to add someone like that as a possible favorite, or Marek Grigorian. We just don't know who that wild card's going to be. So it's easy to put Ouyang Feng as the outright favorite. I think few people would argue that Zora Akopian is the second favorite, but like I said, after that, you can throw a blanket over every other guy in this K1 Max, which is what makes this so special and has always made K1 Max so special. It's the fact that it's always been such a hard tournament to call. I know there's only ever been less than a handful of winners of the K1 Max. Kraus won it once. Sauer, Buakaw, Masato, Petrosian all won it twice. Five winners in the history of K1 Max. There was no one who was ever a runaway winner, not like a Semi Schuld who was, you know, in a short period of a few years was untouchable in the K1 heavyweights, and it was almost a certainty that Schuld was going to win whenever he was in the Grand Prix. In fact, whenever he was in the Grand Prix, he did win. You could never say that for K1 Max, and you can't say it this year for K1 Max either. It's such a closely contested tournament, which is always what's made it a pound-for-pound fan favourite. But once again, it is a deep dive here into Ouyang Feng. This is the guy to watch. The body shots are exquisite. The work rate is there. The physique is there. From a marketability perspective, if the dude learns to speak English, he's the total package. But the entrance is superb. He knows the mind games. He knows the physical games. And he's the number one gun in this tournament by far.
Thanks, Michael. Let's take a bit of a deep dive now and listen to part of the interview that I had with former K1 Max star and longtime commentator in Japanese for K1, Yoshihiro Sato. Hope you enjoy this. Let's hear what he has to say about Ouyang Feng. Yoshihiro Sato is a former WKA Muay Thai World Welterweight Champion. He's also the K1 World Max 2006 and 2007 Japan Tournament winner and runner-up in the K1 World Max 2010 Finals. We spoke to him today about the K1 World Max 2024 Tournament Finals and more specifically, Ouyang Feng, in today's Superstar Interview. Just a little caveat before we get started. I want to let you all know that Michael was traveling this week, so I had to do both the voiceover for Sato-san and do the interview questions, so it sounds a little bit schizophrenic. I've put a vocal effect on my questions to make it sound a little bit deeper and manly, but we hope you'll bear with us despite this kind of strange technical necessity, and it's a great interview. We hope you enjoy. Sato-san, thank you so much for joining us today on K1 Battlecast. It's really a pleasure to talk to you. I've been a fan of yours for a very long time. And we'd like to ask you today about your thoughts on the fighter many say is favored to win the tournament on July 7th, and that is Ouyang Feng. Would you tell us what you think Ouyang Feng's strengths and his weaknesses are?
I think Ouyang Feng is at his strongest because he really has the whole package. He's got excellent technique, impressive power, and quick speed. He's also got a strong heart and a very durable body. He's got it all. His performance is consistently high level across the board, but his weakness is actually related to his strength. Because he's so consistent in every area, if he goes up against someone who exceeds him in every aspect, he doesn't have a way to set himself apart. Typically, if a fighter excels in just one area, they've got a decent shot at pulling off an upset, even against an opponent who's more skilled. However, Ouyang Feng is such a well-rounded fighter that it's tough for him to overcome somebody who's better than him in all aspects. Despite this, when he faced off against Hiromi Wajima and won, Ouyang Feng's fame really took off. His reputation soared significantly. Now, when you take a close look at that match, you can tell that he didn't win that by luck alone. He won it with real determination. He fought with both strength and skill, and because of that, emerged victorious. So Ouyang Feng is going to have to face the wild card, and although we don't know who it's going to be yet, we've heard a few names that would give anyone pause. Even if Ouyang wins, he's sure to take a lot of damage. Now, as someone who's fought in a few one-day tournaments, maybe you could tell us what it's like to go through something like this.
When it comes to the one-day tournament, there's a definite disadvantage between somebody who favors kicks because you're striking with parts of your body that are exposed, like your feet and your shins, and a boxer who wears gloves to punch. I mean, obviously, the more you kick, the more your legs get worn out. So the strategy has to change drastically. I really think of them as different sports. The strategies that you have to employ are radically different. So in the tournament on July 7th, what's going to be most important for Ouyang Feng is durability. I mean, he's a tough fighter. He can probably keep throwing his strong kicks and not have to worry about it too much.
But even the toughest of fighters always have to be careful about getting injured. That's something you want to avoid.
In your experience, what's the difference between a one-day tournament and a one-off match? And how do you think Ouyang Feng is going to fare in a tournament like this?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I've experienced one-day tournaments, and they're really an animal all to themselves. You know, I've noticed that a lot of people who've never been in one tend to have a lot of opinions about them. But when I was active as a fighter, I often thought, if you know so much about it, you should try it yourself. One-day tournaments are really tough. And I'm not really sure why, but once I even had blood in my urine. Yeah, I was pissing blood. And it came from the damage to my legs. I was shocked. Because it's not something that you expect, right? It really surprised me. Blood from internal organs tends to be black, but mine was red. Gosh, it shocked me. So I went up to my manager and I apologized, saying, it looks like I've got internal bleeding. I've been peeing blood. And he says, huh, well, there's not much to do but go on. And this was just before the finals. I mean, I was so nervous, but I pushed through and managed to win by first round knockout.
In order to make it through something like that, you'd have to have an incredible amount of mental toughness. Do you think Ouyang Feng has that toughness, what it takes to make it through these three rounds?
Oh,
yeah. I think Ouyang Feng is an extremely tough fighter mentally. You never really see any weakness shown on his expression. So even if he accumulates damage to his legs, you probably won't really know about it unless he gets knocked down.
Well, how about outside the ring? I mean, we still don't know who his opponent's going to be. That must be taxing mentally, don't you think?
I imagine he's feeling a bit anxious because his opponent hasn't been decided yet.
Do you think it'd be tough to prepare for the tournament not knowing who he's going to face? I mean, other people know who they're going to face, but he has no idea at this moment. So I imagine he's having a hard time knowing how to prepare.
I mean, there's not really that much to think about other than the date of the match, and that's already decided. So he can practice in an approach that is pretty much straightforward. He just has to focus on improving himself. I mean, he's actively aware of this and is working on improving his skills and preparing himself mentally. But of course, it's easier when you know who you're fighting. I mean, you can devise a specific strategy for somebody, and it mentally allows you to prepare just to take down that one opponent.
I imagine it would be a lot easier for the person who's in the wild card position, not just because they're a really experienced fighter, probably, but because they know who they're going to fight.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about the wild card opponents, there's also a lot of speculation about them. And considering that they've been training specifically with Ouyang Feng in mind, the wild card already knows who he's going to fight. So Ouyang Feng knows that he can't coast through this.
Okay, let's look at the quarterfinals themselves. And if you could talk just a little bit about the difference between the dynamics of that first match and somebody who goes fourth.
Well, to get into the specifics, the first and fourth matches are separated by a lot of time, giving the person in the first match much more time to rest. In a one-day tournament, a difference of just 1 or 2 minutes can have a really big impact. Now, if you've never competed, you might not think that it matters that much, but let me tell you, it does. Fighters who go up first have an advantage for sure. That's why when I was back in my prime in K1 Max, many of us would choose to go first if we drew the number one slot in the lottery. The fourth match has much shorter breaks, and it's tough because you have to go right back into the ring without time to rest. I fought in both the first and fourth matches and know the difference.
Can you go into more detail about how that downtime affects you?
Because the break times are different, it really affects how much mental breathing room you have. If you're in the fourth match, you have to start getting ready right after your first match ends. It's really crucial to take off your gloves for a bit once the match is over. I definitely wouldn't recommend keeping them on the whole time.
Once a match is finished, it's best to take off your gloves, your foul cup, and your ankle supports. Really, all the tight gear that you have on should come off. This helps to get your blood flowing better, which in turn speeds up your recovery. You know, if you stay sweaty, you just feel more worn out, and it makes it a lot harder to keep your arms up in later fights. So even though Ouyang Fan is at a disadvantage by not knowing who the wild card is, at least he's got an advantage in the lineup.
Is there also an advantage to somebody who has tournament experience? I mean, Gago Drago, our interview with him, he talked about how he, when he was finished with that first match, he was so satisfied with it that he just wanted to go back to the hotel. How do you stay in the game?
Well, like I said earlier, it's a totally different game. So if you're thinking, I won one match, now I can head home, well, I'm sorry, but you're playing the wrong game. In this one-day tournament format, you absolutely cannot afford to lose focus even after winning once. It's all about maintaining concentration. If your focus drops after the first match and you start wanting to go home, you've already lost in terms of the tournament. Everyone needs to keep their mental focus the same level the whole tournament. It's really the person who remains focused, who can refocus after their fight and stay concentrated, who wins in the end. I've been a big fan ever since watching you beat Buakaw, and it's just been such a pleasure to interview you today. Thank you so much for your time, Yoshihiro Sato, everyone.
Wow, some interesting thoughts there from Yoshihiro Sato. And Jonathan, you can't possibly ask for a greater expert than Sato, who made the K1 Max final, never won it, but made it to the final, and also is the commentator for Abima TV currently.
I totally agree with you, Michael. And these little tricks, like how to keep your circulation going in between the matches and the benefit of just getting that focus and maintaining it, that was really enlightening for me. So what a pleasure to talk to him. All right, moving on. All right, let's go into the listener mailbag and take a question from, let's see here, Doug from Boyle Heights in Los Angeles. And he asks, when you celebrated Badahari's knockout of Alistair Overeem in the 2009 K1 Grand Prix semifinal, did Alistair Overeem get pissed off at you? Come on, Michael, tell us the inside scoop.
Doug, really good question here, mate. And this is a really good, interesting question. So we go back to that 2009 K1 World Grand Prix, where the entire Grand Prix's storyline was the big hope that Bada and Alistair would meet. They were both matched on the same side of the draw, but they both had different quarterfinal opponents. So they had to both win their quarterfinals to advance to the semi and meet each other for the right to fight in the final. Now, when I say storylines, you may be wondering, hold on, Chevello, how can you have storylines? This isn't pro wrestling, nothing scripted. Of course, it's not scripted in K1. But we always have an idea of storylines we want to push through the product. And my longtime director, who I absolutely love and adore, Sasaki-san, who is still the director of K1 these days, has always been a genius at helping to concoct and construct these storylines. And the one that we had going back then in 2009 was this huge MMA invading K1 and the K1 fighters having to defend the honor of K1 against these marauding MMA fighters. You know, we saw Masato have a fight at the Budokan where he took on, was it Kawajiri, I think it was, Kawajiri was the MMA invader, so to speak. And when Masato beat him at the Budokan, that infamous video where you see Gago Drago going nuts in the background, that was a huge win for both, you know, for K1, for Masato and for K1 over MMA. Because don't forget, at Dynamite in 2008, we saw Alistair Overeem, this MMA monster, but largely unknown in K1, fight Badahari. And Bada was the hottest thing on the planet in K1 at the time, and Alistair knocked Bada out. There were a lot of reasons and behind-the-scenes stuff that happened, and that may be another story for another time, but it did set this storyline of MMA marauders entering K1 and trying to beat the K1 legends at their own game. And don't forget that Alistair Overeem, you know, came into K1 and started wrecking people, absolutely wrecking people. It didn't look good for K1's experienced fighters to start getting picked off by Overeem, you know, who was an MMA guy. So leading to the 2009 Grand Prix, this was the big angle, the big storyline, and we were just really praying that Bader and Alistair would meet in the semifinals, which they did. On commentary, it was myself and Mike Kogan and Ray Sefo, and I said to the guys, and this is a story actually I've never said before, so this is a K1 Battlecast exclusive. I said to the guys before the fight, Alistair and Bader, I said, boys, if Bader Hari wins against Alistair, let's high five, let's clap, let's celebrate, let's go stupid on it. And Sasaki's going to be ready to turn the ringside camera on us to catch us celebrating, because it was just going to be a natural extension of how we felt at the time, to be honest. I just wanted to make sure we got it on camera so we could incorporate it into the broadcast to sell how important it was and sell our feelings about defending K1. I mean, Ray Sefo, K1 legend, right? Mike Kogan, K1 executive. And me, the biggest K1 fanboy in history, we're there commentating. We're feeling these emotions. We're all secretly and outwardly hoping that Alistair doesn't beat Bader Hari, because we don't want MMA beating K1. We don't want MMA beating K1's biggest star. So when the fight ends and, you know, Bader beats Alistair and the camera cuts to us and we're high-fiving and I'm screaming, it's over, and we're clapping, and Ray's getting into it, and Mike Kogan's getting into it. That was genuine passion that we felt, because we felt that K1's honor had been defended against this invader, this invading one-man army from mixed martial arts named Alistair Overeem. Fast forward now to the following morning at breakfast at the hotel, and this gets particularly back to your question, Doug. I'm sitting there having breakfast by myself. I believe it still was the Shintakanawa Prince Hotel back then. And Alistair walks into breakfast, and he's by himself as well, gets his food, sits at the table in front of me, diagonal to my left. I remember this clearly. So if I'm sitting down, he's at my, let's say, my 10 o'clock. And he starts eating. And I'm getting a little nervous because, listen, I'm great friends with Alistair these days, but I didn't really know Alistair back then. And I'd taken the press conference, I'd taken that fight to next level, as I described earlier, the clapping, the cheering. I mean, it's not often that a commentator cheers and claps and celebrates one person beating another. It's almost unheard of. But then again, you know, we never did anything, you know, we never copied anyone else. We cut our own path. And that's always been one of the great things about K1. So I'm sort of a little worried. Alistair's by himself. I'm here by myself. What if he gets verbal with me? What if he wants to eat me for breakfast? Guy's freaking huge. So a couple of minutes later, Alistair turns around to me and he stares at me. And I'm like, oh, shit. Alistair Overeem staring at me. Oh, God, where's Ray Sefo when I need him by my side? And he gets up from his table and he walks over to me. And I'm shitting myself right now. And he leans over me and he says in a gruff voice, hey, you're the commentator. And I swallow hard and I'm like, yep. And he looks at me and I'm thinking, oh, shit, I'm about to cop a slap here from Alistair Overeem. He sticks out his hand to shake mine, and he goes, just want to say you're an awesome commentator. Great job. And, man, my shoulders fall, and I'm relieved, and I go, thank you so much. I shake his hand. I go, man, you know, I hope you enjoyed everything. You know, you didn't mind us celebrating the fight and what happened at the press conference, etc. And he goes, listen, I know it's all part of the game. He goes, I know it's all part of selling the fight, selling the storyline, and you did it really well, so thank you. And he went and finished his breakfast. And after that, Alistair and I became great friends, you know, over the years. We still stay in touch. We did a Voice Versus together in Korea. We've hung out together. He used to invite me to his fights in the UFC in Vegas. Alistair is a top bloke, by the way. Absolutely top bloke. Very intelligent. And that encounter between us at breakfast just shows that Alistair gets it. And that's a big thing, a message I want to send to other fighters out there. You've got to have the ability to separate personal from business. Us celebrating Bader's win over Alistair was business. It was emotional, sure, but it was business at the end of the day. It was a storyline we were selling. It's what got so many eyeballs on K1 in that period. Our ability to say MMA's invading K1, we've got to defend its honor. It's a storyline WWE has done heaps in the past, right? You know, have a look when NWO, WCW, you know, the NWO invasion of WCW. What a massive storyline that was. So we were trying to replicate, you know, not replicate, do something similar in that MMA was invading K1, right? Like NWO invaded WCW. So guys like Alistair got it. Guys like Bader got it, okay? These are super nice guys who know the game, how to play the game. And I want to encourage other fighters, have a game, have a game plan, have a storyline, have a character you can sell. But know that it's just that, it's business. At the end of the day, these K1 guys, and I tell this story all the time, we would be at the hotel, the Shintakanawa Prince Hotel in Tokyo, in the lobby, and Ray Sefo is having a coffee with Peter Ertz, who's having a coffee with Stefan Leko, who's having a coffee with Remy Bajaski, who's having a coffee with Jerome Labana, who's having a coffee with Ernesto Hoost. And they're laughing, and they're chatting, and they're shaking hands. 3 days later, they're bashing each other stupid inside a ring for 3 rounds, bloodying and beating each other up. Senseless. After the fight, back at the hotel, they're all gathering together again and hitting Roppongi and going out for a night on the town. That's what it was like. There was never any hatred between anyone. There was no like, I hate this guy, I've got to hate him because I'm fighting him. It was never like that. It was respect. It was friendship between the guys. But at the press conferences, they knew how to turn it on. They knew how to give a quote. They knew how to give a soundbite. They knew how to give a move or make something look good for camera that could sell the fight. They knew it was nothing personal. What's that Godfather line that Michael Corleone says? It's strictly business, nothing personal. It's strictly business. They got that. And Alistair Overeem got that. And I wish that more fighters would get that because it's really important. Doug, really good question. And again, thank you so much for allowing me to peek behind the veil for all of our listeners once more and give you an insight into the old school workings of K1. And I'm telling you, a lot of it still applies to the workings today of K1 and every other successful fight organization out there. Doug, great question, mate. Thank you. Well, Jonathan, it's time to close this episode of K1 Battlecast. And, mate, I've got to say, this was a fun episode.
Well, I hate to sing our own praises, but I'll take the compliment. And it really, you know what? It was so great to hear the story about Alistair and the behind-the-scenes strategy that they use to create these narratives that get people hyped up about the fights, which is a great thing in my opinion. And the interview with Sato-san.
As always, Jonathan, great to share the airwaves with you. Folks, join us again next week. We drop a new episode every week coming up to the K1 Max because we've got plenty to profile and also leading to the K1 World Grand Prix in Sarajevo on June 29. Until next week, I'm Michael Schiavello.
And I'm Jonathan Scheer.
Thanks for joining us. Catch you on the next episode of K1 Battlecast.
You can hit us up on all the socials. We got the Instagram, we got the Facebook, we got the Twitter, we got all that good stuff. And we're thinking about maybe switching over to a YouTube format. Nothing decided as of yet, but we'll let you know as those developments happen. There might be some more news next week. I don't know. There's always some kind of delay. I hate to keep you guys on pins and needles, but the wild card's gonna drop pretty soon. All right, everyone, have a wonderful week. We will catch you next time. A new episode drops next Friday. Have a great week.